101.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and we serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. We want to get to your phone calls in a moment, and we got a lot to talk about today. We'll be following developments in the shooting that happened today at Fort Stewart in Georgia. As those developments come in, five members of the military shot. A man is in custody, and we'll find out more about that, but there is very little in the way of detail available right now. I do want to talk about a story that is terribly tragic. It's about a 16-year-old who died of a fentanyl overdose, and now the man who supplied him with that drug has been convicted, and he got a 13-year prison sentence, except most of the media, nearly all, I'll give credit to the ones who did it right, most of them have buried the real story there, and that is that the man was not legally in the United States. And but for the sanctuary policies of places like Oregon and Washington, people like that would have been removed from this country a long time ago, and Griffin Hoffman, 16 years old, might well be alive because the man who supplied him with that deadly drug was an illegal alien, is an illegal alien, and now taxpayers are going to be paying for his three hots and a cot and medical care and probably college and probably representation in court. We're going to be paying the tab for that. But he is an illegal Mexican national living in this country. I don't think that issue is raised nearly enough. But let me get into the details of that in a moment. First, welcome to the program. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, well, we're going to put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our X poll also has to do with death and violent crime. I'd like to know whether or not former Governor Kate Brown, she was the accidental governor of Oregon. She had to succeed John Kitzhaber after John Kitzhaber resigned in disgrace just 30 days after his inauguration. He had to leave office because Kitzhaber had been allowing his gal pal, Sylvia Hayes, to peddle influence from the governor's office, and Kitzhaber had to resign. So Kate Brown took his place, won re-election, and then finished up her two terms of office and left. And now she's been replaced by Tina Kotek, who is arguably even worse than Kate Brown. But consider this. Back in 2021, Kate Brown, then governor, decided that a man who had been convicted in 2019 of assaulting a Portland police officer, burglary, and car theft, he got just 4 years in prison, and Kate Brown decided, nope, he doesn't have to serve that time. She wiped out and commuted the rest of his sentence and set him loose. Now, if the police are right about Jesse Lee Calhoun, about a year after Kate Brown set Jesse Lee Calhoun free, according to the police and according to the indictment that he now faces, four counts of second-degree murder, that he murdered four young ladies and abused the corpse of at least one of them and dumped their bodies starting in 2022. So not long after Kate Brown cut him loose, we know that's a fact. He was convicted. He was sent to prison. He served less than half of his sentence. And then Kate Brown decided to cut him loose. I would imagine in 2021, she used the pandemic as an excuse for that. But then again, liberals, you do just about anything to set criminals loose. They'll tell the police not to arrest people. They'll tell the prosecutors not to prosecute. They'll tell the judges, all of them appointed, by the way, by Democrat governors for the last 30 or 40 years in the state of Oregon, they'll tell them, don't send these people to prison. Let me tell you how bad it is. In Oregon, if you're convicted of a felony, that is the most serious kind of crime. Do you know what percentage of convicted felons actually do even one day in prison? It is 25%. So 75% of the worst of criminals do not a single day in prison. And then Democrat governors and Democrat parole boards and Democrat judges and Democrat prosecutors all decide, no, you shouldn't even have to do that. Well, Jesse Lee Calhoun was set loose, and now the police and the prosecutors say he began a murder spree right after that. We'll see if that is true or not, whether or not it can be proved in court. He does get his day in court, but I would like to know whether or not somebody like Kate Brown should have to publicly come out and acknowledge, I set that man free. He is now an accused serial killer, and four young ladies are dead. I think the answer to that is yes. She should publicly acknowledge that. You can find the X-Poll today at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Yesterday, I asked you this about Delia Ramirez, member of Congress. Should Congress expel members who publicly declare that their first loyalty is not to the United States of America, but is to a foreign country? In the case of Delia Ramirez, the child of illegal aliens, who, at least by my interpretation of the 14th Amendment, is not even an American citizen herself, and yet she holds a seat in the American Congress, and then she declared that her first loyalty is to Guatemala, not to the United States of America. Should the Congress expel people like that? 98% of you said yes to the question. Only 2% of you were naysayers. So glad to take your calls on that as well. Let me get back to Griffin Hoffman, 16 years old, died of a deadly fentanyl overdose back in March, 3 years ago. So just over 3 years ago in 2022. Where did he get those drugs? He got them from Manuel Antonio Souza Espinoza. Now, if you read most of the stories about this man and the 13-year prison sentence that he just got for dealing fentanyl to Griffin Hoffman, who died of a fentanyl overdose, you will not see mention that he was in this country illegally. I'm proud of the fact that KPTV, my old alma mater in television news, actually saw fit to put it in the very first sentence, because I think it's significant that if somebody ends up ending the life of a person and he shouldn't have even been in this country, it's very much a front and center issue, because right now the U.S. Department of Justice has listed both Seattle and Portland as two of the 35 sanctuary jurisdictions that are actually obstructing federal immigration enforcement. In other words, President Trump, whether you like him or hate him, and I know that some of you actually hate President Trump, I don't. I think the guy's a great president. He wants to enforce the law. He wants to remove people like Mr. Espinoza, the man who killed Griffin Hoffman. He wants to remove them from the United States. And what are Seattle and Portland doing? They have decided to obstruct the enforcement of federal law. And so now the Attorney General Pam Bondi may actually go after both Seattle and Portland and say, if you're impeding federal law enforcement, you heard this threat a long time ago from Tom Homan on this show. He said if those local officials are going to stand in the way of enforcing the law, some of them are going to end up in handcuffs, some of them are going to be accused of crimes, and some of them are going to face prosecution, and in my book, they should. Glad to be with you, and always glad to take your calls. I'll get to those calls and the Northwest nonsense coming up next on the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
Scratch off.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense? Christmas.
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead, fish wrapper, or mainstream media bias.
Back when Oregon Republicans a couple of years ago walked out of a legislative session to block lawmaking that they knew their voters opposed, they were first condemned and then legally forbidden to ever run for that office again. But when Texas Democrats fled more than 1,000 miles on a private jet to Illinois to block congressional redistricting in Texas, they got applause, at least from their fellow liberals. Gerrymandering, they shout. Every 10 years, the United States does a census so that members of Congress can each represent a district with about the same number of Americans, around 800,000. When Democrats draw the lines, they claim they're on the side of the angels. When Republicans do it, it's that evil gerrymandering stuff. Consider the results here in the Northwest, which has been gerrymandered to a fare thee well. Oregon Republicans cast 42% of the votes. They get 16% of the seats in Congress. Hey, does that sound fair to you? How about Washington State, where 20% of the seats in Congress go to Republicans, but GOP voters cast almost twice that number of votes? Is that real representation? In Massachusetts, the home of Senator Pocahontas, Democrats take the prize. 35% Republican voters in Massachusetts, zero members in the House of Representatives. Democrats, soon to become the Democrat Socialist Party, they hold double standards or they'd have none at all. Your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Our question of the day is brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Dagny Taggart writes in, I think that's a nom de guerre, Blanchet House was on television news last night on K2 saying they plan to open a women's shelter that can hold up to 75 women. Will this include trans women? If the point is a safe place for women, how can they possibly allow men to stay there? And yet they can't turn them away because they're trans. Imagine the repercussions from the woke Portland maniacs. I'm very curious to see how this is going to pan out. Dagny, I plan to put in a call to Blanchet House. Not sure they'll ever call me back. My favorite post on X today, and this is a young lady who signs herself Gen X Gal 90. Okay. This woman found definitive proof that Sydney Sweeney is a Nazi. She owns a German Shepherd. That's right. So all you white people that own a German Shepherd, you're all Nazis. All of you non-whites that own one are Nazi adjacent. And at the very least, the non-white face of white supremacy. Certain amount of sarcasm in that one. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I would point out that for the last 10 or 20 years, it's become apparent that newspapers are in a death spiral right now. But one of the reasons they're in a death spiral is that they put such crazy stories in them. I saw one of them last night in which the story went on and on and on about what all the tax changes wrought by the United States Congress and by President Trump to preserve the tax breaks in the one big beautiful bill. And they went on and on about how much this was going to cost the state government. And I got to thinking, do you suppose the folks at the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper think, we write this newspaper for the state government of Oregon. We don't actually write it for the majority of our readers who happen to be citizens who pay taxes. We write the newspaper to represent the state government. Because if you read far enough into the story grudgingly admits, quote, that's how much Oregonians and businesses operating here will save on their tax bills. But the headline and the majority of the story is one big sad story about how much money the government is going to lose, while at the same time, private citizens and businesses are going to save that amount of money. They care what the government loses. When that rag finally shrivels up and dies, you know, OregonLive.com, the only ones who are going to mourn it are going to be the people with PERS pensions. Our best email of the day, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. They did it for me. It is a beautiful job. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or call 855-CAP. That's 855-CAP-THAT. Valerie writes in, Lars, I just want to point out that nobody ever talks about when it comes to mail-in voting. The Democrats say too many people don't know how to get an ID, so they can't vote. I just want to point out the Democrats have not produced one community nor one person that actually hasn't been able to vote because they didn't know how to get an ID. Please put that on your show. I think we should push that point. The Democrats have not produced one single person who hasn't been able to vote because they don't know how to get an ID. Doesn't make any sense. By the way, she signs Valerie, and no, I'm not Russian. That's just the way my parents spelled my name with an I. I am a real woman, and I am not a Russian. To your calls now at 866-439-5277. Let's start with Shane. Hey, Shane, welcome to the program. What's on your mind on this Wednesday?
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me. So I read on X last night that Senator Adam Schiff, that, by the way, has already been censured by the House of Representatives for unethical behavior, that Pam Bundy has referred him for prosecution for his mortgage fraud. But I believe that Attorney General Letitia James, New York State Attorney General, she's been a thorn in Trump's side as well, and she's been accused and of conducting, carrying out mortgage fraud, of having a primary residence in both New York State and Maryland, I believe.
And Maryland or Virginia, one or the other. And you're right. I think Schiff is guilty. Now, what they have done is they've started a criminal investigation, and it's a federal investigation, because Schiff bought a house in Maryland. And he told the bank that it was his primary residence, even though he claims to represent, as a U.S. senator, he represents right. California. Do you know why it's important what you tell the bank about what is your primary residence?
I believe so, because it's for tax purposes. I mean, if you represent the people of California, and then your primary residence is either Virginia or Maryland or whatever, so Oregon for that point, so you're not really representing the people of California.
You're not, but the important thing is that when you sign those mortgage documents and you say to the bank, this is my primary residence, typically on a primary residence, you only have to put down 10%. On something that's not your primary residence, you typically have to put down 20%. Now, with houses, especially in places like Maryland and the West Coast, houses coming in at $500,000 or $750,000, imagine the difference between having to put down, say, $100,000 down instead of $50,000 down, or $200,000 down payment. It's a gigantic difference. It usually means a difference in the interest rate you pay as well. And so if you lied to the bank to obtain a loan, then you have committed mortgage fraud. They went after Trump on that, even though Trump told the people he borrowed the money from, these are my properties, this is what I think they're worth. You should establish for yourself what you think they're worth. And all of the banks said, yep, we've looked at them, we're happy to take those as collateral. All of those loans were either paid back on time or ahead of time. The banks were happy. Trump was happy. The only person who was unhappy was Tish James of New York State. And Tish James, it seems, herself has committed mortgage fraud. And it sounds like Senator Schiff has as well. I'd love to see him in handcuffs and a jail jumpsuit.
The Lars Larson Show. The 40th president of the United States always knew where to put the blame.
You have blamed mistakes of the past, and you blame the Congress. Does any of the blame belong to you?
Yes, because for many years I was a Democrat.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday, and I've always looked forward to talking to Nigel Jaques. He won a Pulitzer Prize for reporting at Willam Week. He's now with the Oregon Journalism Project. And when it comes to stories about numbers, Nigel is your go-to guy. So the question is, Nigel, why would Oregon waste millions of dollars, refuse good advice, and then throw the taxpayers' money down the toilet and then punish their kids and their communities for the cuts that have to follow because of those losses? Why in the world would they do that?
Well, it's unclear, so I'll offer you some potential explanations. We're talking about the Oregon Investment Council's over investment in a thing called private equity. Oregon has about twice as much as the average pension fund around the country. We have a large pension fund here, about $100 billion. About 26 or 27% of that is invested in private equity, again, more than twice the national average, roughly speaking. And why that matters is because private equity investments have lagged badly behind other investments, and specifically publicly traded stocks over the past number of years.
Hey, Nigel, I want to interrupt for a moment and just ask you to explain. I know what private equity is, and you know all about private equity. Explain to my audience what private equity is shorthand for.
Sure. That's when an investment management company gets funds from somebody like the Oregon Pension Fund, and they buy companies with it, hoping to hold those companies for 7 to 10 years, cut costs, maybe add to some debt, and then resell them. So the distinction, the word private distinguishes private equity investments from publicly traded stocks, like a stock in Amazon or Nike or Intel. So back in, decades ago, Roger Meyer, who was then the chair of the Oregon Investment Council, led Oregon into being one of the first state pension funds that invested in private equity. And I think that's one of the reasons we've stayed in longer than we should. There's just a long history. And for many years, private equity was a great investment, but it hasn't been lately. And the pension fund, Lars, hires experts to go out and really do a lot of research and come back to them and say, here's the way that you should allocate this $100 billion in order to meet your future liabilities most effectively. In other words, the pension fund exists to pay people after they've retired, so you have to have money set aside for that. So how would you best approach that? So we pay more than $1 million year for that advice, and one of the main points of this week's story is that we have consistently for years ignored that advice, and last year alone, ignoring that advice cost the pension fund about $1.4 billion with a B dollars, and that's money that didn't go to hiring police or teachers or firefighters or paying for other public services. So it's a huge miss. An enormous miss, and it's a little bit complicated, but I think my colleague Jim Neff, who wrote the story, did a great job of breaking it down in a way that will be pretty simple for everybody to understand.
And by the way, make this simple as well. When they lose that kind of money, then the pension managers say, oh, the fund is short. We need to get more money in it. So then they go to every single public body, every county, every city, every school district, and say, because we're short, you have to pony up more money. So all these school districts and sheriff's offices, fire departments, cities, counties, etc., all say, our bill just went up by hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars that we have to pay in because of the losses by the investment geniuses at the Oregon Investment Council, right?
That's correct. So this year, there are 904 government bodies in Oregon that pay into this pension fund. They're going to pay 27% of payroll, which is the highest rate they have ever paid. And they're going to pay that high rate in part because of this inexplicable mistake that our pension fund managers have made by ignoring the very expensive advice that they paid for. It's a little bit like going to your doctor and your doctor says, gee, Lars, you've got a serious heart problem. Let me send you to a cardiologist. And you say, you know what? I feel fine. I'm going to ignore that advice. I'm going to ignore what the experts tell me I need to do. And we've done it for a few years now, and the costs are dramatic for those 904 okay. Government payers.
One other difference in that metaphor, I think the metaphor is useful. If I ignore the doctor's advice and go on about my way and drop dead of a heart attack, I suffer some. In the case of the people who rejected the advice, including one guy who is the highest paid guy in the state of Oregon, makes over $800,000 a year, he ignores the advice, loses the money, and he still gets a big fat paycheck, and so do most of the people, the investment managers who work for him?
Yeah, that's true. That Chief Investment Officer Rex Ginn is still employed today, as is most of his team. I think part of what we found while looking into this is that everybody's in charge, so nobody's in charge. So the governor appoints four people to the investment council, and then the fifth member of that investment council is the elected state treasurer. Then they have a staff of investment experts who work for them, and then they farm out the investments to other experts. And collectively, there's been a lot of discussion over the past 5 years, say that we are too exposed. In other words, we have too much private equity in our portfolio, but we haven't really brought that number down substantially. In fact, well, we're going to buy more of it.
We're going to buy more of it, and yet the benchmark they use to say, are we doing a good job, is the Russell 3000 Index, because this gets way beyond my understanding, but I know you know this field well. They say, if we're doing well, we're making Russell 3000 Index returns plus 3%. Was that about it, what Neff wrote?
That's correct. So the Russell 3000 is just another index that is a proxy for the stock market as a whole. It's more closely aligned to the entire stock market than other better known benchmarks like the Standard & Poor's 500 or the Dow Jones Industrial Average. So just think of that as a proxy for the stock market. And because private equity is more risky than stocks, you should earn 3 points more than the stock market as a whole.
So last year, what would the Russell 3000 have returned? Wasn't it 38%?
Correct.
Okay. And what did they actually return?
Somewhere around 5%. I don't 5%. Know the exact number.
So instead of 41, they earned 5. And could they have simply said, let's take all this money instead of private equity, we'll put it in the Russell 3000. They could have done that, couldn't they?
They could have approximated the Russell 3000, absolutely. There are index funds that they could have bought, or the investment companies would be happy to create an index for them that would replicate the Russell 3000.
But if you did it that way, you wouldn't have to employ all these investment managers, would you? You'd just say, well, we're going to pick some index funds, we're going to buy the stocks that are in those index funds, and we're going to simply invest it the way they do, and we'll make 38%. But then you wouldn't have to have a whole crew of investment managers who all get paid hundreds of thousands of dollars, because the decisions are already made for you, right? Do I get
that's
that
correct? You got that right, and it's worse than that, actually, because private equity is very expensive. You pay at least 2% management fee every year on the money you give to these investment managers. You usually give it to them for, say, 10 years. And they get 20% of the profits. With an index fund, you pay a portion of 1%, and you get all the profits. So, and again, as our advisors told us, public equity, that being some proxy for the stock market, has been a vastly better investment over the past few years than private equity. We just didn't listen.
And the real result, in case anybody wonders, why do I care about this? Your kid's school district, your local sheriff's department, is going to have to say, we don't have the money. PERS lost the money. We have to make it up. And as a result, we're going to cut deputies. We're going to cut teachers. We're going to cut police officers. We're going to cut all these other things. Or we're going to have to raise taxes on all the citizens out there. That's Nigel Jaquess talking about Mr. Neff's story from the Oregon Journalism Project. You can find the story at WWeek.com. Back in a moment, if thousands of drivers put highway construction worker lives at risk, should they only get a warning the first time they speed through one of those construction zones? Summer is the...
Gun Control Explained.
Want to stop drunk drivers from killing sober drivers? Ban sober drivers. That's how gun control works.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. I got this email from David about the shooting at Fort Stewart in Georgia. Five people have been shot. We'll get you details as they're available. The shooting suspect has been identified as Sergeant Cornelius Radford. That's what we know about him right now. As we get details, we will share them with you. Five soldiers who were shot are now in stable condition. We know nothing at this point about the motive for that shooting. But David wrote in, and he said, Lars, are military bases gun-free zones so as not to allow military personnel to be able to protect themselves? If so, that needs to change. And I wrote back to David and I said, yeah, for the most part, military bases are gun-free zones. There are service members who are allowed to keep their own weapons, but they're required to be locked up. And it depends on from base to base how those rules go. But we went through all of this discussion back when Nidal Hassan ended up killing so many people at Fort Hood, Texas. And that was decades ago, or more than a decade ago. And the conversation was, how in the world does somebody with a single firearm go onto a military base that's full of people trained to use firearms and manage to kill so many people? And the answer is because most of the military members on the base are unarmed unless they are either working MP duty or unless they are in the middle of an exercise of some kind, which means that it is one of those gun-free zones. And as I keep reminding you, most of the mass shootings that happen in America, 94% of them happen in so-called gun-free zones, places like shopping malls that have put themselves off limits for guns. As far as I'm concerned, when I see those signs say, we don't allow you to carry a gun, I have a state permit for both Oregon and Washington and a number of other states. I would rather be judged by 12 than carried by 6. And I think that you should be prepared to protect yourself just about anywhere you go these days. So we'll get you details on the Fort Stewart shooting. But apparently all 5 service members are in stable condition and they have a suspect in custody right now. Details, more details on him we do not have, but it's Cornelius Radford, spelled Q-U-O-R-N-E-L-I-U-S. I don't know anything more about him other than he is identified as an Army sergeant. He is in police custody, and they suspect him in the shooting of 5 service members at Fort Stewart, Georgia. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. This segment of the show is brought to you by 540training.com, concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. Now, our X poll today, should former Governor Kate Brown publicly acknowledge that she set free a man from prison who is now accused in serial murders dating back to about 1 year after Kate Brown, then governor of Oregon, allowed the commutation of his sentence. His name is Jesse Lee Calhoun. His sentence was commuted in 2021. Police believe he began his killing spree. He is only accused of 4 counts of second-degree murder. He has not been convicted, so he has a right to his day in court. But he apparently, according to the police, began that killing spree in late 2022, about a year after Governor Kate Brown cut him loose. And do you think that people who are former public officials like Kate Brown should come out and publicly acknowledge, I'm the one who made the decision to cut his sentence more than in half and allow Jesse Lee Calhoun back out on the streets? Most of the time, there is almost no accountability for things like that. So should she have to publicly acknowledge that? I think she should. Do I think she will? I sincerely doubt it. Our X poll today is found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, I saw something interesting. I'm not at all a fan of automated policing. And yet, the Washington State Patrol has decided that it will use cameras, speed cameras, to watch over highway work zones. All of us who've driven through these construction zones have seen the signs that say traffic fines double in work zones. Despite that, there were more than 1,300 incidents that happened in work zones in the state of Washington where people would come speeding through, and that put the lives of construction workers at risk. Do I know a way to police that without using automation like speed cameras? I don't. And if anybody's got a brilliant idea for doing it by, what, stationing a cop at every single work zone in the state of Washington during all the hours that they're under construction, which at various times of the year can be all night. Last year, 7 people were killed in crashes in work zones across the state of Washington. 38 incidents caused serious injuries, a total of 1,300 work zone crashes. So what did they do? They put up the speed cams. And already they turned them on in April, and the Washington State Patrol says they have issued more than 7,500 infractions. They also figure, the state figures, that by the time they put the cameras in on all the work zones in the state, they will write about 250,000 tickets every year. The only thing that seems puzzling to me, the state patrol says on your first offense, just a warning. Now, if this is truly about saving the lives of people who work in construction and stopping people from speeding through, causing crashes, and hurting or killing people, should it be a first occurrence is no fine at all, and the fines only start for the second occurrence or next year in July? To me, that makes absolutely no sense. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. And we're glad to take those calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers go to the, well, they go to the head of the line. They get to go first. And we've always had that rule, and we always will. Mark Hester joins me now. 20 years at the Oregonian. I give the Oregonian a certain amount of grief from time to time, including business editor and editorial writer. Now he writes and is a regular contributor at Oregon Roundup. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lauren. Good to be with you.
Hey, tell me this. Is the Pacific Northwest and Portland in particular headed anywhere good economically? And you're answering from the point of view of having watched the business community for a long time. It seems really dim to somebody like me, but I'm a layperson when it comes to business.
There might be slight reasons for hope in Seattle, though they're not as good as before. The column we're about to talk about that I wrote about was the best I could do to come up with glimmers of hope for Oregon, and they are slight to say the least.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of trouble. I mean, Seattle has its share of problems, and it seems to share a lot of the social problems that Portland has. High crime rates, lots of homelessness, somewhat inept leadership for both the states of Oregon and Washington and the cities of Portland and Seattle. So where do you see some glimmers of hope?
Their top companies are in much better shape than our top companies.
Meaning what, Boeing and Microsoft primarily and Amazon?
Not Boeing so much. Amazon and Costco would leave them with Microsoft in third place in terms of current performance. Amazon and Costco are in much better shape than any Oregon companies. Not to mention they and the ones you mentioned are much bigger than any companies we have. We sort of put all our eggs in the basket of our two biggest companies, and one of them might be in a death spiral, and the other one I'm more optimistic about long term, but it's having the worst times it's had since its very early years.
And by one of them, are you referring to Intel?
Intel is the one that could be in a death spiral. And if you watch CNBC, that's not a unique assessment for me.
Well, and by the way, Intel, I would think that we've got more use of integrated circuits worldwide than I think we ever have in history. We've got integrated circuits are used in everything, and people are buying and companies are buying more of just about everything that has integrated circuits in it. And Intel was one of the pioneers. And yet worldwide, we're one of the number one users of integrated circuits. And yet only about 10% of them are made in America, and the other 90% are made somewhere else.
Yeah, but Intel's real problems, they make the wrong type of integrated circuits now. To me, the real irony with the chip industry in Oregon is it's an industry we sort of paid attention to, but mostly we paid attention when Intel demanded we paid attention, and everything is geared toward Intel. Meanwhile, the number one chip company in the world, NVIDIA, doesn't have any operations here, but its CEO and co-founder is from Oregon.
Yeah, in fact, didn't he graduated from what, Aloha High School?
Aloha High School in Oregon State. And it appears that our dear leaders never thought to cozy up to him, and instead of just trying to maintain what they already have, try to make sure they built with something new, which is really the point of the column I wrote, is we don't do much intentional. And as a result, we have these two things I wrote about: what can you look for that we're good at?
Yeah.
And the examples were the airport and the wine industry, which says a lot more about the airport and the wine industry than it does about Oregon. Each of them have some natural advantages, but Oregon has a lot of natural advantages we haven't taken advantage of. But I think the real difference is the state stayed out of the way of those two. The wine industry and beer would be the same. I guess you could throw marijuana in there now. Is among the few that are taxed at a below average basis compared to the same industry in other states. And what makes a difference? Look at, you know, they have their problems because drinking is down and all alcohol producers are struggling. But you mentioned the Intel example. Chip industry overall is still okay, but Intel's not. The wine industry overall is struggling, but Oregon's not struggling as much as others because we created a good operating environment which allowed our wine industry to pursue excellence. The airport's a bit more complicated, and I think it comes down to leadership. Their last two CEOs, Bill Wyatt and Curtis Robinhold, and I knew Bill better than Curtis, although I have met him a few times. They both have deep experience in both government and business, which if you're running the airport, you need that. But you look at the head of other Oregon government agencies, and their experience is mostly deep in government. They don't have that business side.
No, and when somebody who has all that experience in government goes to the private sector and says, I know how to do this better. For example, Tina Kotek recently saying, we don't build enough housing, I will fix that. And I always wonder why reporters, I'd love to talk to the governor, she won't talk to me, but why they don't ask her, what experience do you have in building housing that will allow you to reinvigorate and even double the amount of housing that's built? It seems to me she doesn't have any experience at all.
You are correct. And beyond that, she makes a flawed assumption that many others in government make, and including even a few Republicans, the Democrats are much more likely. They think they can somehow overrule the laws of supply and demand, and that just can't be done.
No, it can't be. And by the way, the only reason I'd fault the airport is the airport kind of has a built-in customer base. People do fly in and out of Portland, and then they get ticket revenues, they get the ticket taxes, they get all these monies that flow to them, and all they have to do is decide how to spend it, which lately they've spent it on a colossally expensive roof, which is beautiful if you built it with your own money. I don't find it as beautiful when it's built with tax money, but that's it. That's Mark Hester. He writes at Oregon Roundup on Substack. Back in a moment. Oh, boy, there is some interesting new information about gerrymandering, about Texas, and about California. And Governor Gavin Newsom has declared we will fight fire with fire. And I'm going to examine that in a moment. Hey, you ever get stuck?
I know y'all think it takes balls to be singing what I'm singing, but I'm just saying what
what you're thinking.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
They're not screwing around. We cannot afford to screw around either. We have got to fight fire with fire.
That is Gavin Newsom, currently the governor of the failed state of California, and someday he hopes to run for president of the United States, and by someday, I mean 2028. So what is he talking about? We're going to fight fire with fire. He's talking about gerrymandering. He's trying to kind of hitch his wagon to what is going on right now in the state of Texas. And just so you understand, gerrymandering is when you write the districts, draw the districts around American citizens. This is not that hard to understand. The Constitution says that every 10 years, there must be a census of everybody in the United States. Now, unfortunately, the United States is now counting illegal aliens in that crowd, and they used to number much smaller numbers. Now they're in much bigger numbers. So much so that California would probably lose 4 or 5 members of Congress and 4 or 5 presidential electoral college votes if they were to exclude illegal aliens from counting in the census. But once you get the new census back, and they always come in the years that end in a zero. So census in 2000, census in 2010, census in 2020, that census is what determines where the legislative districts are run. And just this is people try to make this sound more complicated than it is. It really isn't. There are 435 members of the United States Congress. We currently have about 330 or 340 million Americans. So every member of Congress is supposed to represent about the same number of people, around 800,000 or just below 800,000 people per member of Congress. So when a state sees the latest census results and they look at their population and they say, how do we draw the lines so that each of the congressional districts lines up with around 800,000 people who live in the state? It's not that complicated, except that the people who wrote the rules in the Constitution and the people who imagined redistricting knew that it would be a political process. Don't let anybody fool you and say, we can't let this be political. It is inherently political. Whoever is in the majority in the state of California, Democrats are very much in the majority. Republicans don't have the votes to beat them. So the redistricting of the state of California is done based on lines drawn by the Democrat Party, not by the Republican Party. Now, there are about 25 red states in America where the lines are primarily drawn by Republicans. And the Democrats routinely pitch a fit every time Republicans draw the lines, as they are in California. In this case, so much so that a whole bunch of Democrats from their state legislature climbed on a private plane, apparently paid for by Beto O'Rourke. You might remember he ran for president once, didn't work out that well. But then again, he's a convicted criminal, so who would want him anyway? And they flew off to the state of Illinois, they flew off to California, they flew off to New York to escape the state and deny a quorum. I think all they're doing is delaying the process a bit. But this got Gavin Newsom all fired up. So he's decided that he wants to redistrict the state of California. He wants to redraw the congressional map, even though that is, well, it would override an independent commission. It was set up. 60% of the voters in the state of California approved of that commission to draw the district lines. Governor Gavin Newsom said, okay, I'm going to run for president in a couple of years. I'm going to redraw the congressional map. I'm going to create 5 more districts for members of Congress that are going to lean hard to the left, and they will likely be won by Democrats. He sees that as benefiting the Democrat Party. And of course, in Gavin Newsom's case, it's all about Gavin Newsom benefiting Gavin Newsom. So what does Bruce Liu, who's running for Congress in California, say about all that?
Gavin Newsom just came up with a crooked scheme to eliminate California Republicans from Congress. Despite Trump winning almost 40% of the vote in California, Republicans hold less than 20% of our state's congressional seats. Now, Gavin wants to gerrymander the map so that Republicans have no seats. It's time to draw a line against this blatant power grab.
Yeah, it is, because you say, well, the Republicans do it too. I'll tell you some numbers that'll help illustrate this. Are the blue states gerrymandered? Yep. In favor of the Democrats. Are the red states gerrymandered? In favor of the Republicans. Yep. How much of an advantage do the Democrats have in gerrymandered blue states? They have 79% of all the members of Congress in those states. You say, well, they're the majority. They get almost 80%. How many do the Republicans get in the red states? 69%, a sizable difference. And so Representative Kevin Kiley, who's already in the Congress, he says California's governor is trying to do something that is completely illicit.
California Governor Gavin Newsom is trying to completely throw out the window the principles that have guided our redistricting process in California and that are part of our Constitution. Our Constitution specifically bars doing redistricting in the middle of the decade, and it sets up an independent citizens commission for drawing district lines.
Yeah, and they set up that commission. They came up the lines as they stand right now. As what does Gavin Newsom plan to do? Take the Constitution, throw it out. Take the citizen commission approved by voters and throw that out and redraw the lines so that it helps him out and helps out the Democrat Party. And Representative Kiley points out this actually disenfranchises the voters.
They said that we don't want politicians drawing lines for their own district. That's an inherent conflict of interest. We want it done by an independent commission of citizens based on feedback from citizens all across California who can draw districts that actually make sense. And now the governor is trying to short circuit all of that, to blow it all up, to throw these principles out the window, to return power to his and other politicians' hands, precisely what the voters said they didn't want.
Yeah, and let's get back to Texas, though. One thing to point out to you, Texas has been gaining population dramatically. California and other blue states are losing population. And why? Because Americans are fleeing from the policies of Gavin Newsom and states like Oregon and Washington and New York. People are running away as fast as they possibly can, and many of them are running to Texas. So what happened when Texas got all that new population? Well, except for an error that was made by the Joe Biden Census Bureau that actually cost Texas the seats, they should have had two more seats in the House of Representatives. So the seats were almost certain to land in Republican hands. And so the Democrats are going absolutely crazy. They say, we have to fight this. Well, how are they fighting it? By refusing to take part in the decision. Representative Kiley says that's a threat to everybody else in America.
I don't love what's going on in Texas, and I don't like the idea of this happening all across the country in this sort of domino effect of one state after another. I don't think that's good for Republicans. I don't think it's good for Democrats. I don't think it's good for voters. I don't think it's good for representatives. I certainly don't think it's a good thing for the country.
So just consider this. When you watch what's going on in Texas, the Democrats have said, why, if we stick around at the state legislature, the majority Republicans will vote on redistricting and it will be done the way they want it done. Yeah, the same way it's done in all the other blue states in America. In other words, every single time that there is redistricting, if the Democrats are in charge and they draw the district lines to their advantage, as the system sets up for them to do, they say that's just doing it the way that the rules say you have to do it. If the Republicans do the very same thing in states where the Republicans are in the majority, all of a sudden the Democrats call foul. Now, I want you to know, I always admit that the Democrats have double standards, because without double standards, they'd have no standards whatsoever. But this fight in Texas and the fight of Democrats running all the way to Chicago to try to get away from voting on redistricting the state, it puts the votes and the presidency in 2028 very much at risk to the schemes of the Democrat Party.
The Lars Larson Show. He may talk about serious issues, but even Lars has a sense of humor.
I have a joke for you. The government in this town is excellent and uses your tax dollars efficiently.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and a real pleasure to welcome back our friend Leland Vittard, host of On Balance with Leland Vittard and chief Washington anchor for News Nation. And Leland, I do read war notes every day, and you say, so goes Texas, so goes the United States. It does seem to be that way right now, with the governor of California trying to leverage his way into redistricting his entire state over the objections of his own voters, and apparently over the law and the Constitution and everything else. And the Democrats want the, I guess, the Republicans in Texas to say, oh, no, we'll let you Democrats redraw all the districting lines in a red state. Does any of that make sense to you?
I'm not sure what your point is.
My point is that This is a process that the people who wrote the rules way back when knew would be inherently political. Whoever was in the majority was going to be calling the shots. Those in the minority could sit on the sidelines and whine or complain, but it wasn't going to change anything. You've got states in America that are blue states, and they are drawn the way you'd expect blue states to be drawn. Massachusetts is a good example. 35% of the voters are Republicans. They have zero members of the House of Representatives from Massachusetts. And you say, well, that's the way the Democrats do it. But every time the Republicans say, well, in red states, we're going to draw the district lines, the Democrats pitch a fit, hop on a private plane if there's one available, and fly off to Chicago to one of the most gerrymandered states in America, the state of Illinois.
Yeah, and then when Democrats do something like they did in California, where they change the voting rules so that there's not a Republican and a Democratic primary. There's just a ranked choice primary, a jungle primary, and then the top two in a runoff, then you're guaranteed to have two Democrats running against each other no matter what. So you'll never have a Republican in statewide office, and it makes it even harder for Republicans to win in what few Republican districts there are. The problem with American politics is that we continue to reward the extremes of both parties, and therefore then the extremes of both parties keep getting more extreme to satisfy the more extreme parts. We can do that, and eventually it is going to have really terrible effects on the country. I think the question is, do you love your party more, or do you want to set up a situation where America has the best chance to continue with the values and the ideals that got us to the place that we're at right now?
The latter, of course, and you know that's a question that already has an answer built into it. But in that case, what happens when then Republicans fight, I think, but I've got a bias. They fight by the Marcus of Queensbury rules, and the Democrats fight by street fighting rules, and they're going to win. And so the Republicans are left with two choices, lose or start fighting street fighting.
I'm so tired of this argument. I'm so tired of this argument because Democrats say the same thing. Republicans fight by street fighting rules, and Democrats are always, the House of Commons rules or whatever highfalutin English language he is. Okay, so both sides now, argue the facts when the facts are on their side. They argue the law when the law's on their side. When neither are on their side, they pound the table and say, the other side's doing worse, and we have to fight harder. Look, you're an opinion guy. I'm a journalist. Both sides do this. The problem in American politics is that it's not do unto others as others have done unto you. It's do a little bit worse than others have done unto you, which that's the law of escalation, right? That's the reciprocity multiplier. But it does not end well. And I think we're seeing that. We see it why so many Americans in the middle, which I don't think you count yourself as somebody in the middle, so frustrated because they don't feel right. First honest thing you said so far in our time together.
What?
That wasn't fair. That was a little too.
He's cranky because he's newly married, I think. So.
You know, there's something to that. No, I think you're right in everything you say that Democrats have done bringing Republicans to this point. And I'm right to say that at some point it has to stop, or we just end up basically with a choice of the most extreme. Now, last night, George Will on the program made the point that somebody's going to figure this out, and somebody's going to figure out there's a lot of people in the middle who are unhappy, and the market will provide relief for all of us normies.
Well, for example, when you say in the middle, take California, very liberal state, 60% of their voters said, hey, don't mess with the districting in the middle of the decade. And they weren't writing that to restrain the Republicans, were they? Not in a state like California. They were writing that to restrict the Democrats and say, don't do this. And Gavin Newsom said, hey, it's good for my presidential campaign in 28. I'm going to do it anyway, over the objections of almost two thirds of my voters.
Yeah. And I think the most extremes of each party are being rewarded because Gavin Newsom knows that he's going to be running against J.B. Pritzker. I guess running is a little bit generous when talking about J.B. Pritzker, but Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Joke. Yeah.
He's
going to be rolling.
Crazy. You have to explain it.
Pritzker is rolling. You can, and I know you'll use that. You know that his campaign is rolling now.
Yeah, it's rolling right to Iowa, I guess. But I think the point is that Newsom realizes he has to be more extreme than Pritzker, and Pritzker is the one harboring all of the Texas runaways. So there you go. It's fairly obvious when you just look at it, not from an outrage sense, but just from what's happening and why it matters, which is what I tackle. And you bring the heat in the fire, Lars.
But I'm trying to look at this and figure, what's the end game? Because you run off to Illinois, you're holding up legislation on a bunch of other practical stuff like flood relief and things like that that's currently not moving at all in the legislature. And do they really think if we sit in Chicago long enough, the Republicans will cave in and say, you go ahead, you draw the districts any way you want and just capitulate to the Democrats? Do they really think that's what's going to happen?
Of course not. They think
then what's the point? What's the end game?
That we're talking about it and that they're raising money off of it.
And that they're drawing attention to, because the number that jumped out at me, and I know you like numbers too, is you have blue states, and in the blue states where they call the shots, 79% of the members of Congress are Democrats. And in the red states, say, well, the red states do the same. I know you're trying for moral equivalency. Say, well, in the red states, it's only 69% Republicans. So is there more gerrymandering that is done to benefit the Democrat Party? I would argue the numbers say it is.
Okay, so Democrats are 10% worse than Republicans.
Yes,
okay.
At least.
Okay, well, there's your numbers. Look, I would be very happy, and I know if you want America to work, okay, draw straight lines. Just require that all congressional districts are drawn with straight north, south, or east, west lines, and I guarantee you Washington will start to work a lot better.
I would go for that, because if you think about it, you say, well, 10% worse. What's a big deal? Hey, Leland, any consequential decision by the U.S. Congress was decided usually by one vote or two votes out of 400. I'd say 10% is a tremendous advantage.
That's true. Again, if we want Washington to work, create a situation where you have more than 20 or 30 competitive House seats. Look, this is the fact. Okay, most Republicans talk about make America great again. You ask, when was America great? The 1980s. Okay, mm-hmm. These were the times. Okay, guess what? That was with Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan. Why? Because both parties were forced to compromise. Why? Because there were a lot of swing congressional districts. Even when Ronald Reagan won every state but one in 1984, he had to compromise because congressional districts were split.
Exactly right. That is Leland Vittert from News Nation. Leland, thank you very much.
Ever wonder what a vegan actually is?
They say cows are bad for the environment because all they do is eat plants and fart, just like vegans.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday on the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you. If you want to check out our X poll today, we try to come up with an interesting and provocative question every day. Today was relatively easy. Should former Governor Kate Brown come out and publicly acknowledge that she set free a man from prison early who is now accused in 4 serial killings? These all involve the deaths of young ladies. Jesse Lee Calhoun is facing 4 counts each of second-degree murder and abuse of a corpse for allegedly killing the women and then dumping their bodies throughout the Portland metro during the 5-month span late 2022 to early 2023. He had been arrested 8 times when he was convicted about 6 years ago for assaulting a Portland cop, for burglary, and for car theft. He was sentenced to 4 years in prison. Yeah, about half the time, half of his way through that prison sentence, then Governor Kate Brown commuted the rest of his sentence in 2021. Now, do you remember when Governor Brown told the public, well, you know, it's 2021. We've still got the pandemic going on. We have to reduce prison populations. We've got to cut costs. All the usual stupid arguments. Because if you want to count the cost of locking somebody up, it's roughly about $1,000 a week or less. Some prison inmates, it costs $30,000, $35,000 a year. So it could be just under $1,000 a week. And you say, that's a lot of money. Well, if you imagine, what does it cost to have criminals who are real, unrepentant criminals out loose in a community? Is it more than $1,000 a week? Well, you got a few armed robberies, you have a couple of ordinary assaults, and already I would suspect that you can monetize that and say that's a whole lot more than $1,000 damage. It would be cheaper to leave this person locked up. But then what happened? Well, according to the police, Jesse Lee Calhoun, according to the charges against him, started killing in late 2022, continued killing into 2023, and four young ladies are dead because of it. I would like to see Governor Kate Brown come out and do a mea culpa and say, I'm the one who decided to let this guy go. And she was telling the public routinely, oh, no, we're only letting people go if we think there's very low chance of them going out and committing other crimes, and especially crimes against people. I mean, it's one thing if you steal a car, if you burglarize an unoccupied house, but when you go out and murder people, there is no way to come back from that. And in this case, a guy who had assaulted a Portland cop, committed burglary, car theft, and everything else, arrested eight different times, and finally convicted, finally imprisoned, and Kate Brown let him go early. And now four young ladies are dead. Today's Ex-Bull, should former Governor Kate Brown publicly acknowledge she set free a man who's now accused in four serial murders? Today's Ex-Bull is found at Lars Larson Show and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, I got to tell you, I want to get some of your calls here in just a moment. Let me go first to Ron. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I hate Kate Brown as much as you do. But I
don't really hate her. I just think she was a terrible leader. So.
Oh, totally agree.
Don't hate her personally.
But I will say this. I would like to know who's in charge also of the prison system.
Who's the governor.
Who advised her? Like, you can say, hey, look, this guy, man, he was the heckest firefighter we ever had. He ran into the fire and everything else. He needs a break. But somebody's got to be there going, hey, look, Governor, this guy's not too stable. I don't think we should let him go. You know, there's not a lot of Ted Bundys out there. I mean, Bundy was smooth. Nobody knew what Bundy did.
Well, except, Ron, when you say there aren't them, here's the thing I always point out to people. The worst kind of crimes you can commit are felonies, right? Can we agree on that? Not misdemeanors, not violations. They're felonies.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what percentage of convicted? And again, you have to commit the felony. You have to get caught, which is also a percentage game. Not every felon gets caught. And then once you're caught, they have to decide to prosecute you. In many cases, they don't prosecute you at all. They look at the case and say, we don't think we can convict this guy, so they don't even prosecute it. Then the judge has to decide that you're due to, you know, that you've done something bad enough, you need to be sent to prison. Ron, would you like to guess what percentage of convicted felons, the ones who got caught, got arrested, got prosecuted, got convicted, and got sentenced, what percentage of them go to prison in Oregon? Do you know?
I don't want to know the answer to that question.
It's 25%. So in other words, you take the worst of the worst, and not all of them get caught, but of the ones who get caught and convicted and prosecuted and sentenced, one in four goes to prison, the other three go free. So if I said to you, what kind of people do you currently have locked up in prison, Governor? She would have to say, well, we got the worst of the worst of the worst. We got the ones who committed felonies, that's bad enough, and then they got caught, and then they got prosecuted, all of which is, you know, becomes a smaller and smaller circle of people. And then finally, the person who actually went to prison, one in four, that means the people you're considering letting out of prison are the worst kinds of criminals that you have in the state of Oregon. And then she does have people who...
Isn't there those... I was going to say, isn't there though somebody advising when
yes,
she says
yes, but ultimately there are people advising the governor, but at the end of the day, it's the governor herself who has to say, let this guy go or let this woman go or keep the woman in jail. It is her decision, and yes, she has advisors, but she's the one who makes the judgment call.
The Lars has maintained.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you live on the Radio Northwest Network, and happy to welcome my friend Ari Hoffman, who does the talk show on our Seattle affiliate, KVI. He joins me now. Ari, welcome back.
Great to be here, buddy. Thanks for having me.
Now, I guess at some point we could talk about the Trader Joe's fridge fornicator, but why don't we leave that for a little bit later on in the segment. Let's start with the election results, because I want to know, is there any good news coming out after the primary election and the possibility that maybe Bruce Harrell will no longer be the mayor of Seattle, because there's almost no good news coming out of elections in the state of Oregon. I've looked for it. There is not much to be found. So is there any good news in yesterday's vote?
There's no good news in Seattle. There is a little bit of good news in some of the legislative races for the Washington State Legislature, where you can see that there are two winnable seats, and those two winnable seats would actually be great and stop the Democrats' supermajority. In fact, there's also one or two moderate Democrats in a couple of other races that have shown time and time again. For example, one's name is Kevin Schilling. He's the mayor of Burien. You might remember his name because he's the one who went head-to-head with King County because he wanted to enforce camping bans. So this is a guy who has gone head-to-head with Democrats before. He would not be a rubber stamp. So there are three or four races we're keeping our eyes on to make sure the Democrats don't get that supermajority in Olympia. But aside from that, zero news last night, unless you're a progressive in Washington. And the truth is, that's bad news even for you. Because if you're going to get your entire wish list of the progressive agenda, that means all your costs are going to go up too. And the progressives are going to be sitting there wondering, why did my rent go up? Why did my gas prices go up? Why is homelessness still bad? And somehow still blame Republicans.
Well, in fact, that seems to me to be the most sensible thing heading into next year's elections, you know, to say, do you really want all this stuff that's happening? Except I see things like the DNC chair, Ken Martin, coming out and saying, yeah, we got lots of room for people like Zohran Mamdani. I mean, it's a big tent. They're trying to say that the Democrat Party is a big tent. It's a big freak show tent for the most part. And they've got people like a full-blown communist who may become the mayor of New York City. And yet none of the I don't see any of the Democrats saying, hey, this guy does not represent what most of our constituents want. Are they just bound and determined to drive their numbers down into the dust?
Well, actually, I disagree with a lot of people on this one on our side of the aisle, because I look at what happens in Seattle. I look what happens in Washington. It's not that Zohran Mamdani is following. It's not that we're following his model. He's following our model. Here, they've been going more and more socialist for years. It started back with Kishama Sawant, probably a little bit before then. But it's been going downhill towards communism, towards Marxism, towards socialism. The Democrat Party in Washington, as we saw from the last legislative cycle, they are the socialist party. They are the Marxist Party. They are the Communist Party. Zohran Mamdani is just a better-looking version of that because he looks like he knows what he's talking about. He looks like a young, slick guy. He's better at selling it than somebody like Kishama Sawant, who they don't want anything to deal with. But this is nothing new for our area, and what I'm worried about is Democrats right now are doing so badly in the polls nationwide that they're going to say, this guy has a key to winning. He's like that kid who offers free lunch when he's running for class president and has no authority whatsoever to do so. And unfortunately, everybody votes for the free lunch kid rather than the kid who goes, you know, we should talk to teachers about tests and that. No. they vote for the free lunch. And what I'm worried about is we see in Minneapolis, we see that there's a guy who's already copying the same thing, who's running for mayor. You're going to see more of that. And the fact that the Democrats like Chuck Schumer, like Nadler, like all these guys are embracing this guy shows they're trying to cling on to power even by betraying their own party values and dragging the whole Democrat Party that way. Now, some people may say, wow, this is great for certain wins in red states, but blue states are only going to get bluer and bluer and bluer and more and more down the socialist road.
Well, I guess you may be right in your analysis of that, but I keep wondering, I've always heralded the idea, you know, that Franklin had of laboratories of democracy. Hey, you want to try all that socialism stuff? Go ahead. See how it works out for you. The problem is all those states are bleeding population right and left. And, you know, for example, the big fight over gerrymandering in Texas, well, you know, the Democrats don't like gerrymandering unless it benefits them, in which case they do it. So they make their state so toxic that the residents of the states, when they have the capability, move away to some other state. That state gains congressional representation, and blue states like California lose it. And at some point, it'll self-correct, but it's likely to take decades for that change to actually happen, isn't it?
I'm not sure that's entirely right, and let me use the proof of Washington State. Over a million Californians moved here. Now, Californians moved to a lot of places. We know they moved to Florida. We know they moved to Texas. We know they moved all over the place. But a bunch of them came here because they said, okay, we destroyed our state, but where's a place that's liberal but not totally destroyed? And they came up here. And now they're doing the same thing to Washington that they did to California. You have a whole bunch of celebrities from Hollywood who bought places in eastern Washington. If you want to know why states like Washington are getting bluer, it's because all these people came here from California, and all of the normal people moved out to places like Idaho and places like Florida. And that's why I think you're going to see blue states getting bluer, because you also have the mass migration of the people who are red. So, for example, take this for a minute. In New York, Lee Zeldin lost the governor's race by around 400,000 votes. Well, how many people moved to Florida in that time? It was around 400,000 people at that time. And those are probably people that would have voted for a Lee Zeldin.
And if you can't get the changes, well, what happens when people say, I can't tolerate California, Washington State is still relatively liberal, but not as bad as California, so I'll move to the place that's not quite as bad, but I'll bring with me, as you say, all of the inclinations that gave you leadership like California has right now, that is dragging what should be one of the most prosperous states in America, they're dragging it into the economic gutter. They're going to end up with an elite at the top, kind of like Mexico, 2% at the top, 98% at the bottom, nothing in the middle, and that's what they're going to go for. And then they leave there because that's intolerable, and they come to Washington State and bring the same voting patterns to Washington.
Yeah, exactly. And it's only getting worse here. And you see that they're doubling down on these failed policies. I asked myself, I said, okay, we had the defund the police movement. That didn't work out well. Maybe this is rock bottom. Okay, we had the autonomous zone. Maybe this is rock bottom. But no. And now we have the largest tax increase in state history. Is this rock bottom? It just seems like the people out here keep saying, yeah, hit me with more taxes, hit me with more homelessness, hit me with more drug overdoses. We're here for it.
Well, and in fact, you've got a state in Washington, and I'm appalled because I'm a Washington voter. You've got a state health department that's come up with a plan saying maybe we can fix it if we get certified illegal drugs that are safe and then give the drug addicts a safe place to take the drugs supplied to them by the state. And when you talk to your friends in more conservative states, they say, your state's going to buy illegal drugs for drug addicts? Oh, yeah, because then they can take them safely and they'll be dosed properly. They'll be able to maintain their addiction and not die of an overdose. And they think you've absolutely gone crazy, or at least your state has absolutely gone crazy. Ari, thank you very much. That's Ari Hoffman. He holds down his own talk show on our affiliate station in Seattle. In a moment, I want to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. A big win for the fight against ID and vote by mail coming up next. Summer is here.
At least someone has a plan for illegal aliens.
Back in the White House, I will terminate every open borders policy of the Biden administration and begin the largest deportation operation in American history.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'll get to your calls in a moment, but I've got to tell you about a decision that was made yesterday by a federal appeals court, and it has specifically to do with both vote by mail and voter ID. The ID number requirement is designed to confirm that each mail-in ballot voter is precisely who he claims to be. Now, that seems like common sense to me, but what the federal appeals court decided late yesterday is that there is a Texas law, and what it says to voters is, if you want to cast a mail-in ballot, they limit the people who get mail-in ballots primarily to those with physical disabilities or some other problem voting. Not like the states in America where everybody gets a mail-in ballot and there is no chain of custody. Well, the Texas law said if you want to use a mail-in ballot, you're allowed to do that. But you have to submit identification to cast a mail-in ballot. Now, Donald Trump liked that idea. I like that idea as well. A three-judge panel on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit ruled 3-0 that that requirement does not violate federal law. Because, of course, the people who didn't want to follow the Texas law said, no, 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 we shouldn't have to have voter ID just to be able to cast a mail-in ballot. Well, the state's Election Protection and Integrity Act of 2021, so it's been on the books almost 5 years, requires a person to submit their ID before they register to vote by mail. We have no difficulty concluding that this ID requirement fully complies with a provision of federal law known by the parties, that is the people who brought it to court, as the materiality provision. Fancy lawyer talk. They also said that mandating potential voters to submit their name and their address was not enough. And why would it be? You go in to register to vote, and they say, what's your name? You give them the name. You give them an address. Okay, that's plenty. That's all we need to see. We don't need to see any voter ID at all. It made it crazy. One of the federal judges, Judge Ho, actually wrote, that information is easily available to anybody who simply requests it. As a result, any person could request and receive that information about a registered voter, use that information to apply for a mail-in ballot, then cast the ballot with a minimal risk of detection. Now, why do we think that's happening? Because we've seen it happen in recent elections. So, what does somebody do? If they're willing to break the law to win elections, and it seems clear that there are people out there who are willing to break the law because they know that in most cases, even if they get caught breaking those election laws, it's not going to actually create a problem. You're not going to get prosecuted. You're very unlikely to get caught. So what do? They go out and they find people, because you can go to the elections headquarters in almost any state and say, I'd like a list of all the voters who are registered to vote, but they have not cast a ballot in, say, the last two presidential elections. So they're being carried on the rolls as a registered voter, but they haven't cast a ballot. Now, if you go out and use that name and address and you get a mail-in ballot sent to you at your address, you now have a ballot. It is from somebody who doesn't vote, but they're registered to vote. But they don't cast ballots, which means when you cast a ballot in their name, how likely are you to be caught? The way you'd most commonly be caught is if you use somebody else's name, but there's somebody who votes on a regular basis, and they go in to vote, and they're told, I'm sorry, sir, you've already voted in this election. And you say, no, I have not. Show me the ballot where I voted in this election. And then you determine that somebody else is using your name. But if you have a list of all the people registered to vote, but who don't regularly cast ballots, that gives you a list of people whose identity you can steal for the purpose of voting. And here's what Judge Rodriguez wrote. The court concludes as a matter of law that a voter's ability to provide the ID number associated with her voter registration record is not material to her voter qualifications under Texas law. Now, the attorney general of the state said voter ID is one of the most crucial tools in the battle against election fraud. And Trump on Truth Social said, this is great news. It should be nationwide. And I would tend to agree with him. It should be nationwide. The federal court has now said that Texas can require potential voters to list their ID information in their application for a mail-in ballot. Otherwise, you don't know who is asking for that information. And in that case, you're not going to be able to stop voter fraud. Let's go to Bob. Hey, Bob, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Bob, 72 years old, Camino Island, Washington. First-time caller. Love your
Thank
show.
You.
Retired. I got a question for you.
Sure.
My history of voting has always been voting against one candidate rather than for a candidate. So conservative, construction, around that kind of stuff. But now I'm finding it harder and harder to not get triggered. I watch more news now. I probably shouldn't. But not get triggered by wackos on the left. And some of those people are my relatives now, younger relatives. So I've got brothers and sisters that are gone.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just beyond the pale. But their kids, I want to be part of their life, but they've adopted this crap. And I'm trying to not have it trigger me when I
crap?
See them.
I mean, when you say this crap, you okay, say you've always voted against candidates rather than for a candidate. I guess yeah. I understand that. I try to vote okay. for somebody I believe in. But what's yeah. the thing that's triggering you?
Okay, so one was, we're out having a few beers, and my nephew was blasting Trump for suing CNN, or CNN paying them for the Kamala Harris interview that they tweaked.
And CBS is probably the suit you're talking about, where Trump said you falsely edited this interview with Kamala Harris, and he might have yeah. also sued CNN, but he did successfully sue CBS. So your nephew had a problem that if somebody does something to deliberately alter the outcome of an election and you can prove it in court, that he objects to suing over that?
Yes. And he says that's a loss, you know, where our democracy is heading to hell, and loss of First Amendment, you know, by a news outlet and stuff. And I'm going, you got to be freaking kidding me.
No,
and
but
I probably had that.
I mean, I guess all you can say to that nephew is, well, you're wrong. I mean, because if you say to yeah. him, should news organizations be able to direct the outcome of an election or tailor their coverage so that one candidate wins and one candidate loses? I would think that even the most liberal person would say, no, we shouldn't allow news organizations to try to tilt an election one direction or the other, unless he believes in that.
So here's my question. This might yeah. be more of a psychological.
Well, you're going to have to get to it quick because we're going to come up to a break.
How do you control your emotional side so that you can reasonably articulate a reasonable opinion?
You ask
Is
questions. I mean, I've found, Bob, I always like questions best. If I were talking to your nephew, I'd say, so it's okay for a news organization to tailor its news coverage so that one party wins and the other party loses. And if he says yes, I say, well, so you're not really going to vote in an election because the outcome of the election will be decided by a small number of people at the news organizations or the major social media. Are you happy with that result? Where your vote doesn't really matter, the decision on who wins and who loses will be made by a few hundred people, maybe even a few thousand people at news or social media organizations and not by you. Are you okay with that? I think asking questions like that is the best way to get somebody to think about the implication of what they're saying. Donald Trump is wrong to sue. Oh, okay, so you're all right with CNN deciding who should win. Because I know that if CNN got its way, Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris would have won. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. A message from Lars.
I'd like to apologize to anyone I've not offended yet. Please be patient. I'll get to you shortly.
Who's next? This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails, and we'll do that in a moment. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers always go right to the head of the line, always have, always will. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. So two data points. Number one, crime seems to be on the decline across America. Obviously, individual cities may have different results locally, but across the country, crime seems to be going down. but assaults on police are going up. And I thought we'd ask Dr. Curry Myers about that. He's a criminologist, former sheriff, and former state trooper. Dr. Myers, welcome back.
Always a pleasure, Lars. Thanks.
Did I hit the data points right? I mean, crime seems to be going down, even at the tail end of last year, and yet assaults on police are going up.
Yeah, and the crime going down can be a bit speculative, and I'd like to address that.
Please do. I think I know where you're going to go with that. People have just given up on reporting crimes.
Yeah, so the first is there's fewer officers on patrol and reduction of proactive policing, which certainly affects counts. Decriminalization and data artifacting is significant. As you know, decriminalization means we're not enforcing the law in many areas that we did before, which would deflate statistics. And there's also such a thing as in New York in particular. Of course, we had Proposition 47 in California, where vast amounts of property crime and drug crime was not investigated at all. And in New York State, since 2019, there's been a rise in dismissals because of state statute. In some cases, more than 4,000 cases have been actually dismissed, which means it would affect the crime rates. And so you throw in those things, but here's the blunt truth. Officer assaults have become really a dissident counter trend based on the information. In 2024 alone, there were 85,730 officers that were assaulted. This is an all-time high. By the way, this is FBI data. To give you an example, there was only 43,649 officers assaulted in 2021, which is amazing because in 2020 and 21, we had, of course, the summer of love, significant riots. And so we're showing that it's a big escalation that has occurred. And it's not a coincidence. It's an endemic. It's targeted. And it's occurring because of four different things. The weaponization and ambush tactics have begun. People are using firearms more, and they're actually using military tactics. We've seen an evolving offender mindset. That's the anti-police rhetoric and social contagions that are going on that are anti-police. And it's fomented by politicians that that talk badly about police. And then a lot of this has occurred during operational intensity. So it's during high-stress environments like riots and inactivity that's occurring. And all of a sudden, you just have a mass amount of people, which makes the threat situation pretty significant.
Well, does that also mean these are not assaults that are coming on cops from conventional criminals? In other words, the criminal who's out to commit some other kind of crime, the rapist, the person who commits criminal assault, armed robberies, things like that, these are politically driven assaults? Is that it?
That's correct. We're seeing an increase in motivation that's based on that evolving offender mindset. I've made the argument, and I've said this before on your show, that we're seeing a different criminal archetype that's occurring, one that's much more based on anti-government rhetoric, and it's, again, fomented because of the social contagions that we're seeing, especially in groups, in masses, and through the Internet.
Except for one distinction I'd like you to make, and just tell me if I'm right or wrong about this, not a yes or no, but in past decades, we've heard the police, the FBI, the DOJ, and others say, well, we have all these, say, white nationalists or Christian nationalists. They're terms I don't agree with, but they'll use that terminology. And they'll say, it's these conservative groups that are anti-government. Well, Dr. Myers, I'll admit, I'm anti-government on an awful lot of things. I mean, I see the need for a strong military, a defense of America, public safety, police, you know, fire, emergency services, things like that. I also think the government does a lot of stupid things, too. And I'm anti-government in the sense that I want them to stop doing it. But I'm not anti-government in saying, let's go out and kill people. You know, let's go out and kill police officers and things like that. So there's a real difference between saying, I want the small, contained government that the Constitution promises. The federal government with the enumerated list of things it's supposed to do, that's its lane. Local government that stays in its lane. And yet governments just want to grow. They want to grow like some, you know, weed that just keeps, you know, it's like a friend of mine used to say, a ducks quack, dogs bark, and regulators regulate. Government constantly says, we need to have control of more things, right down to your light bulb and how you heat your water. You know, and you say, no, you don't belong in any of those areas. Stick to the jobs that you're not doing well now elsewhere, you know, in other areas. Pave the roads, educate the kids in public schools, leave the rest of us alone as much as possible. But that's not anti-government saying, let's go kill people. Is the anti-government, in general, anti-government assaults, is that being carried out by the right or the left, or is there a political label you can put on which direction it's coming from?
Oh, you can absolutely put a label on it. It is definitely socialist left in groups that are associated. The things
the
that you
Antifa,
mentioned earlier.
The BLM and all that.
The Antifa, Trantifa, all of those are part of it.
Oh, by the way, draw that distinction because a friend of mine, Andy Ngo, writes about that all the time. What is the difference between Antifa and Trantifa?
Trantifa are ones that are specifically designed in response to the anti-trans movement, what they would call the anti-trans movement. So the vast majority of participants in there are identifying as transgender. And we're seeing, actually, when you look at the data on mass shootings, we've seen about a 7% increase in mass shootings that are associated with transgenderism.
And what explains that? I mean, other than, say, the mental illness of a lot of trans people.
That is it. About 80% of people that have identified have some sort of gender dysphoria, have significant mental health issues in which they're on medication and seeking treatment for that. It also has an extremely high suicide rate.
And yet, is law enforcement willing to actually call this out for what it is? Because you saw what happened after the Nashville shooting at the Covenant School. And law enforcement acted as though we're going to keep this secret as long as we can. In fact, some of the documents from that incident actually are only now being released, and only because the courts have ordered them released. And you'd think law enforcement would have said, yep, we've identified the motivation. We've got a manifesto. We understand why this individual, at least in their crazy mind, decided to commit these murders, and here's why. And yet they act as though we don't want to tell anybody, even though we know to a fair certainty why this happened. They don't want to say anything about it.
Well, that's the politicization of law enforcement that's occurring. People don't want to talk about motive. Not everybody. There are many law enforcement agencies that will, but especially in progressive areas, you're going to see a suppression of motivation because it doesn't fit a narrative. And that's too bad. It's not transparent, and law enforcement has to be transparent and upfront in the data that they do and in the investigations that we do. We saw this in Cincinnati, Lars, when we had people attacked, and the police chief in Cincinnati actually attacked the media for saying that they were focused too much on the event as instead of going out and arrest.
Yeah, the DEI police chief who was saying, oh, the video doesn't really tell the story. Yeah, actually, I think the video does tell the story very well. Dr. Myers, thanks very much. Curry Myers, criminologist, former sheriff, and state trooper. Back in a moment. I'll get to your calls. You're listening to the Lawrence Larson Show and the Radio. Hey there, it's Lawrence.
And now, this musical message to anyone who wants to indoctrinate our school children.
Hey, teacher, leave the kids alone.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you live on the Radio Northwest Network, serving Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. So this segment of the show is brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialist, Oregon Medical Centers. Hold that thought, Susan. I want to go to naysayer Gordon. I don't want to break 25 years of tradition. Gordon, you're a naysayer. You go first. What do we disagree about that makes you one?
Well, I think the lower courts, with all these Trump victories lately with the lawsuits, should let the lower courts pursue them, because eventually there'll be a transfer of power and the harm to the jurisdiction.
I have no idea what you're talking about. When the lower courts say something and the appeals courts or the Supreme Court overrules them, That's how the system works. What are you suggesting we do differently?
I think it's based on him being on a roll. I say it's going to come back. What suggest we do differently is just let them pursue him, and then the stuff will just ping off him.
Well, like, that's what's happening right now, Gordon. Donald Trump comes out and says, we're going to make this change. It's good for America. Some obscure federal judge somewhere says, I'm issuing a nationwide injunction. You can't do that, Mr. President. And then a higher court, an appeals court, overrules that judge and says, no, President Trump is right. And if they're persistent enough, it goes all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, these lower court knuckleheads, they're wrong. I wish Justice Roberts would actually call them knuckleheads, because they are. And they do ping off of him. So you're not suggesting we do anything different, right?
I suggest we just let it not be a matter of Trump's being on a roll, and just because it's going to come back to bite the conservatives.
Oh, I don't think it's about him being on a roll. I mean, being on a roll, I might say if I went to Vegas and I'm playing blackjack and I seem to win every hand, that would be being on a roll, even though we all know that the cards are dealt randomly. But if Trump is just right on the law and right on the Constitution, that's not about just being on a roll. That's just saying, well, he seems to be right about all these things, and the Democrats are trying to fight him by being wrong. Let's go to Susan in Tacoma. Hey, Susan, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. We are one of the many people fleeing this blue state to a red state. My husband got down there the other day. We just closed on a house, and I'm just waiting for our place to sell, and we're out of here.
He's You're going to Texas, is that right?
We're going to be in Texas. Yes, what my was, husband would rather deliver mail in 100-degree weather every day than have to deal with the garbage that goes on here.
What was the straw that broke the camel's back, if there was one?
Oh, just so many. Just so everything. Just one after another. I mean, I could go on forever like everyone else. But, yeah, it's just, not enforcing, cops not being able to do their job, not enforcing crime. And just turning on the news every night, which I'm trying to avoid. But, yeah, it's everything.
By the way, I your last name's not out there, and I don't know you. But let me ask you a couple of questions. If they're too personal, you can tell me so. What are you selling your house for in the Puget Sound area?
Above five. Lower than six.
Okay, and when you get, you've already looked at houses in Texas?
Oh, we closed yesterday.
Okay, and what'd you end up, did you buy a house about the same house that you had in Tacoma?
Much nicer for a lot less.
Much nicer for a lot less. Do you want to say how much less do you sell your average house in Tacoma for $500 and buy a nicer house for what?
We paid below four.
Below four? That's nice. Yeah. Put $100,000 in your pocket, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, we've got other stuff we got to pay off, but we owe a little bit on this one. But yeah, we're getting ahead, and we're.
Well, I'm going to tell you something
loved this state. It was beautiful until all the garbage happened. But yeah.
Look, I think it's still beautiful, but they've allowed the state to be garbaged up. I mean, California's a beautiful state. Oregon's a beautiful state. Washington is too. But put enough, political crap on top of it, and the beautiful starts to go away. Susan, good luck to you. Let's go to Jason. Hey, Jason, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. I'm a longtime hostage listener to your show. I guess what I mean by that is my 78-year-old father listens to you on full blast volume for about 3 hours a day, so I get to hear all the things I agree with and all the things I don't agree with.
Okay.
But I do hear some good things.
But so you're a hostage. You can't leave, and you have to listen. Well, I'm not in favor of forced listening, but I'm glad you're listening.
So the reason I'm calling is you were talking about the early release that Kate Brown did for a bunch of prisoners. You cited something in there about 25% of people being incarcerated in prison again.
Yeah.
I think that your figure's a little misleading. That doesn't necessarily mean that these people, the other 75%, aren't held to some sort of accountability. Prison only happens for people who are sentenced to more than a year.
Right, because so jail is the lesser, but felonies will send you to prison. Misdemeanors can only send you to jail 364 days. So what I'm saying is, of the convicted felons, only 25% of them serve even a day in prison. They don't serve any time. Now, they may have been in jail waiting for trial. But when you're convicted of a felony, the most serious kind of crime, if only 25% of the people convicted of felonies do even a single day in prison, doesn't that suggest the ones that are in prison are some really, really bad people?
Oh, I definitely agree. I've been one of those people myself.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I definitely agree. There are some felonies that are lesser felonies that do get the up to a year in prison or whatever they get.
That's right, Jason. Thanks.
The Lars.